Good morning. My name is Abby Stamp, and I'm the Executive Director of the Multnomah County Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. Thank you so much for being here today. Before I start, I want to take a minute and recognize the staff of the Criminal Justice Commission, of the Multnomah County LIPSC, and the legislative staff who helped pull together a phenomenal and very big two-day criminal justice conference. And a very special thank you to Christina Yousey, who is our party planner rock star from Multnomah LIPSC. We are very lucky to have her, continued support. Go team. And attention to detail has been wonderful. So every year, the What Works Conference takes on an important and timely theme. This year's conference explores drug law and drug policy. And new this year, the conference serves as a joint judiciary and healthcare committee hearing. And thank you to all of the legislators for being here today. They're over here, shrouded in darkness. But once we begin, what a dramatic entrance. We will have time for some Q&A between each of the speakers. So I want to say just a couple of things before I hand the podium to our next speaker. Individuals who struggle with drug abuse and addiction cost billions to Oregon's welfare, health, and criminal justice systems every year. As representatives of the public safety system, we know many people cycle through our services and our facilities repeatedly without finding recovery or wellness, and we can do better. The national narrative about drug abuse has shifted. In the 90s, we heard about super predators at the height of the crack epidemic. This wrongly maligned African-American communities. But these days, it's different. We hear political leaders from both sides of the aisle talking about the opioid epidemic and the need for more and better treatment. I hope this narrative has shifted permanently. People from all walks of life deserve the treatment, services, and supports they require to be productive members of society. The law enforcement officers and policymakers I work with say we cannot arrest ourselves out of this problem. That's why the agenda this morning will explore a public health rather than a criminal justice response to drug addiction. The three speakers this morning come from across the country and represent a variety of perspectives on drugs, addiction, and incarceration. Dr. Tim Condon will first educate us on addiction and neurology. Mr. Khalil Cumberbatch will speak to us about the adverse impact of drug policy on communities of color. And finally, Judge Frederick Block from New York will address the painful truth of collateral consequences. For detailed information on each speaker, you have plenty of information in your program to consult. So after we hear from our three speakers this morning, we will have lunch. And this is an opportunity for you to find some of your legislators and invite them to sit down with you and have a discussion over whatever you'd like to discuss over our lovely lunch today. One more announcement. For those of you who would like CLE credits for this morning, you can go ahead and access the information at the registration booth, and we'll make sure to get you your credits for today. If you have any other questions throughout this morning, please don't hesitate to ask myself or my staff or the folks out in the lobby to assist you. So it's now my pleasure to introduce my boss, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori. Deborah serves in, Chair Cafori served as House Minority Leader before being elected to the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners in 2008. In 2014, she was elected to lead the county, and during her time as chair, she has overseen reforms to county homeless services and public safety, as well as major new investments in homeless prevention, housing, and key infrastructure programs. And she currently co-chairs the Multnomah County LIPSC with Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. Chair Cafori.
Thank you. Thank you, Abby, and thanks to all of you for coming today. This is the 10th year of the What Works Conference, and it's an important opportunity for us to come together and look at what we're doing right, and more importantly, what we could be doing better. Making our community safe is one of our most solemn responsibilities. But for a long time in this country, we didn't often look at the work that we were doing with a critical eye, examining the evidence and investing our dollars in programs based on their not on their popularity, but on their effectiveness. Here in Oregon, we have been working together to reduce crime, improve the lives of victims and those who have been incarcerated, and get people back on track so that they are successfully engaged with their local communities. But at the same time, when we look at the impact of our work, we still see deep disparities throughout the justice system. Our Constitution calls on us to ensure that justice is blind to race, ethnicity, gender, and disability. But when we look at the numbers, they tell a troubling story. In Multnomah County, we've been working to find ways to make our justice system more effective and more fair. But far too often, communities of color are overrepresented at all levels of our criminal justice system. That's not fair, and that's not just. And until our justice system is proving to all of our communities that justice is blind, we won't be able to fulfill that solemn responsibility of making our community safe. To build safe communities, we need to start by building community. And we've been doing that because we recognize that the safety of the public can't be achieved with one strategy. Drug offenses and property crimes are often markers of something else that's broken down. People are struggling with access to health care, they can't afford to pay the rent or find work. And because public safety is impacted by so many facets of our lives, it can't be addressed by a single agency or a single individual. So we need to work together in close cooperation to make sure that all of our efforts are aligned towards our shared goals. When I became Multnomah County Chair, one of my first actions was to put mental health services into the health department. It never made sense to me that the people who respond to mental health crises weren't part of our overall public health efforts. When government isn't working for people, it needs to change. And institutional reform is the first step. But we need to overcome the forces that have guided our politics to find a better way. That's fighting racial disparities, it's moving beyond the stigma of mental illness, and it's recognizing that addiction is an illness. And we can't build community unless we stop and listen to the stories of our neighbors. Carol Hinojosa grew up in a drug house in Southeast Portland and began using drugs and alcohol at age 8. Age 8. I have an 11-year-old, and it just breaks my heart to think of age 8. By age 46, she was broken, homeless, addicted, and facing prison for assault. Through Multnomah County's Justice Reinvestment, she went into inpatient treatment. She received mental health services, a mentor, and housing. That was 2 years ago. Today, she is clean, housed, and working to become a drug and alcohol counselor herself. Sometimes it just takes that one person believing in you, she said. Our public safety system shouldn't be the front line for people experiencing a mental health emergency. And our jails shouldn't serve as holding cells for people in crisis. The same goes for our emergency rooms. None of us have the resources to meet all of the needs in our communities, but we can improve the way that we work, and we can improve our communities by focusing on what works. By using research to guide our investments, we can make sure that our dollars are really having an impact and that they're stretched as far as they can. And that's what this conference is all about. And looking out today, I see a lot of folks committed to that vision and the hope that if we keep trying, we can and will do better. Thank you.
Right, let's get this underway. So it is my pleasure to introduce Senator Floyd Przanski, who will open the Joint Judiciary and Health Committee meeting this morning. Floyd was first elected to the Oregon legislature in 1994. He served in the House of Representatives between 1995 and 2000 and 2003. Floyd was appointed to represent Oregon Senate District 4 in 2003. He was elected in 2004 to complete the current term and has been reelected three times since 2006. This session, Floyd serves as the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, vice co-chair of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulation, and on three other committees. Floyd graduated from Texas A&M University and later earned a law degree from South Texas College of Law. An avid cyclist and home brewer, he lives in Eugene with his wife. And during the interim, Floyd works as a municipal prosecutor and serves on various legislative committee, work groups, and commissions. Senator.
Thank you, Abby. Everyone, thank you very much for being here. I understand yesterday was a very good day. We have some wonderful speakers that we're going to be able to hear from today. The first thing I'd like to do is for those who have cell phones, if you have not put them on to either airplane or mute or turned them off, if you do that, because we don't want to be disturbing our presentations with the speakers. So with that, the first thing that we'll be doing is gaveling in an informational hearing. This is an informational hearing on what works and public safety conference. And so on the behalf of the Senate, I will gavel in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and at the request of the chair of the House Committee, also the House Judiciary Committee is called to order.
Hi, I'm Representative Mitch Greenlee, Chair of the House Committee on Healthcare. And I'm happy to call our meeting to order.
We're going through all the protocol here and make sure all the committees are actively listening.
I'd like to gavel in the Senate Healthcare Committee.
All right, thank you very much. So for members, there will be an opportunity at the end of each of the presentations to have questions asked and answered. And so with that, it's my pleasure to introduce our very first speaker, Dr. Timothy Condon. Dr. Condon has one of the key areas of his research is going to ask the key question of for all of us here today as to the best response for drug addiction in the criminal justice system. Is it best to have a criminal justice response, or should we be looking at a public health response? And here to help us will be Dr. Timothy Condon. Dr. Condon, again, is a research professor at the Center of Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addictions at the University of New Mexico, who is currently conducting research on the substance abuse treatment within the criminal justice populations. Dr. Condon presents to audiences around the country on fundamental aspects of drug abuse, from how drug impacts the brain and the body to promising treatments and prevention approaches. Through his active research to advance the science of addiction, he helps change the drug abuse and addiction is perceived and the treatment across the globe. His efforts of work has erased the damaging stigma as well as ushering in new health programs on the addiction and treatable diseases. Excuse me. So please take a moment to welcome Dr. Condon. And Dr. Condon, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for that very nice and lengthy introduction. I'm very impressed with myself after hearing all that. So thank you very much. Good morning, Oregon. Oh, come on, a little bit more. I love this, Oregon. So any of you who look through my bio know that I actually lived here in Portland and did part of my training and was on the faculty of the Oregon Health Sciences. It was actually the Oregon Health Sciences University as opposed to the Oregon Health and Sciences University a long, long time ago. So I love Oregon. I thought it was one of the best places that I had ever lived. And so I'm delighted to be here. I actually see Mitch Greenlee, who I know very well from our days working at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And it's always a pleasure to come back here. What I'm going to talk to you today about is essentially going to tell you, I'm going to turn you all into junior neuroscientists. So I'm going to talk about the brain a lot. And then I'm going to talk about some evidence-based practices. But what I hope to take you to take away from the talk today is about essentially why do people behave the way they do when they have a substance abuse problem. And we'll get into that pretty much towards the end of the talk. Again, I've been working on this and these issues for a long time. I was telling the judge earlier that probably about 10, 12 years ago, I kind of had an epiphany that the criminal justice system would be one of the places where the science that we were getting out of addiction research could have the biggest impact on our country. And that would be, in fact, to treat people who had substance use disorder rather than just locking them up. And so I've been working in this area for quite some time, and I've actually done a lot of judicial training. So I'm delighted to be here today. Thank you for inviting me. And I remembered when I got off the plane and got in the car, the rain. I almost had forgotten about the rain, but it was kind of welcome. So what I want to tell you today is about advances in science have revolutionized our way of life. Technology has just taken leaps and bounds, and but it's also changed our fundamental view of drug abuse and addiction. I'm going to date myself, but that's okay because I'm old. Anybody remember this? What is this? Star Trek, yes, it's Lieutenant Uhura, who actually was the communications director in the sci-fi from 1968 to 1969 Star Trek. And you see that thing in her ear? That was science fiction. But this is science fact. And so from 1969 to now, you can see that technology and science has really changed, made science fiction into science fact. Anybody remember this? You're pretty old if you remember this, like me. This is the first computer. This first IBM computer. It filled a whole room. And this was a long time ago. I think I was a youngster back then. But that's what the first computer looked like. And so technology changed the way we look at things and the way we use things. And so science has been a really important part. So advances in science have revolutionized our fundamental understandings of alcohol and drug abuse and addiction. Anybody remember this? Yeah, this was one of the most popular ad campaigns, although people made fun of it, but it's still legendary on Madison Avenue in the advertising business. This is Your Brain on Drugs. Anybody remember the year? 80s, some people say 70s. I've even had some people say, oh, that's from the 60s, to which I respond, if you remember the 60s, you probably weren't there. And so this is actually from 1987 from our good friends at the Partnership for Drug-Free America, which is now the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. And this is the way we depicted your brain in 1987 on drugs. It was an inexact metaphor, very powerful. People made fun of it. But actually, this really got into this substance of substance abuse. And I could remember walking down the boardwalk, seeing people with a T-shirt that said, "This is your brain on drugs," with this, and on the back said, "This is your brain on drugs," with a side of bacon. So this really burrowed down into our understanding. But this was an inexact metaphor, and again, people who were serious about drug addiction said, actually made fun of this and said it wasn't correct. Well, a few short years later, this was again 1987, but in the early 90s, using neuroimaging technologies, and I point this out, you look at this as somebody in a scanner, and as you can see on the left-hand side, that there's a video camera, and that will become important later. So while you're in the scanner, you can actually watch a video, and that's some of the experiments I'm going to show you today. And so scanning technology changed the way we saw our brain on drugs. So this is in the early 90s, work by Nora Volkoff and some of others. This is an example I picked from 1999. This is what we see, how your brain is on drugs. This is the same individual. On the bottom, this individual is given saline or salt solution. And then on the top, the individual was given cocaine. And you can see the areas of the brain that light up like a Christmas tree when that individual gets cocaine. You love that. That is one of the reasons people take cocaine, is because these areas of the brain light up. And they're in the amygdala, anterior pons, lucus sororius. The business part of the reward system is the NAC, the nucleus accumbens, and I'm going to talk more about that later on. But this was your brain on drugs as early as 1991, 92. So it changed the way people started thinking. We could actually look at people's brains on drugs. We could look at people's brains after drugs, and that actually started to change our understanding that, in fact, this resulted in changes in the neurobiology of the brain. So what have we learned? Well, these two simple sentences are the whole talk. Drug abuse is a preventable behavior. Drug addiction is a treatable disease. These are two separate and distinct entities. Drug abuse is a preventable behavior. Lots of things we can do in our communities to prevent people from taking drugs, especially our young people. Drug-free communities, environmental change, good educational programs. But drug addiction is a treatable disease. So once someone passes some threshold and becomes addicted to a drug or dependent on a drug, we need to treat it as a disease, not as just something that's a voluntary behavior. So why do people take drugs? Well, there's a lot of reasons that people take drugs. The risk factors that have been identified from the research are people take drugs at the risk factors are at the community level, the peer cluster level, the family level, and the individual level. And I'm going to focus down on the individual level because that's where a lot of the biology we understand. But we really have categorized people into these two groups. People take drugs to feel good. So people take drugs to escape and to have a novel feeling, sensation, experience, to share them with others. Really, you know, kind of to get high and have and feel really good because those areas of the brain are lighting up like a Christmas tree. But there's another whole group of people who are just taking drugs to feel better. So there are people who, you know, may suffer from depression, anxiety disorder. They actually may have worries, fears. They may be actually in withdrawal. And they end up taking drugs just to feel normal. And I've had a number of participants in any of our studies that, you know, doc, don't even take drugs to get high anymore. I'm just afraid of getting sick by not taking them. So it's really the withdrawal that a lot of people end up taking drugs for. So we have two different groups here then. So there's people who are taking them to have a good time, and then there are people who are taking them to feel normal or to prevent the sick that comes on with withdrawal. And it's not to say that people in the first group can't end up in the second group. But again, it's something to think about in our criminal justice system. Who's who in terms of who's taking drugs for what purposes? A major reason people take drugs is that they like what it does to their brain. This is a very complex psychosocial biological disorder. And addiction has physiological properties. History is important. The drugs themselves that affect the brain mechanisms. Environmental interactions are very important, as we've found out more and more in the last few years. They impact on the behavior, the behavior and the environment interact, and the brain mechanism. So the behavior is the bottom line, and that's drug seeking and use. And so, but it's driven by all these other things. Okay, what have we learned about vulnerability? Because I'm always asked, well, why do some people become addicted to drugs and other people don't? And the answer is everybody has a different vulnerability to become addicted to substances. Everybody in this room has different neurochemistry. You have different amounts of dopamine in your brain, dopamine receptors, serotonin, glutamate, GABA, you name it. There's all kinds of neurotransmitters that actually would determine, you know, in some ways your predisposition, your risk or your resiliency to taking drugs. So why do some people become addicted to drugs and others don't? Well, we don't have all the reasons. We don't know all the factors, but it goes back to some of this. Again, at the individual level, your neurochemistry is very important, but the family is very important. The number one risk factor for children to take drugs are parental modeling. Parents taking drugs, number one reason why young people take drugs. Peer cluster, we know that's important in terms of what the social norms are. And the community, the same thing. The social norms are very important. You know, is everybody taking drugs? Yeah, everybody's taking drugs in my school. Is it true? No, it's not true. And the community environment is a very important factor that can influence why people take drugs. We also know now, and I won't get into a lot of detail, that there's a huge genetic component to substance abuse. And it has to do with all of your neurochemistries being different. So we all have a genetic heritability factor that we can identify with different problems. So for example, I don't have the slide in here, but for example, when you talk about genes, and if you talk about eye color, you can say 100% of 100% heritability is due to genes of your eye color. There is nothing else that will influence that. That 100% of that comes from the genes you get from your parents. With substance abuse, alcoholism, type 1, type 2 diabetes, you know, the genetic load or the heritability factor is more like 50 to 60%. And that doesn't mean you're gonna become addicted to drugs. It just means you have that kind of heritability factor. And so if you go back to the previous slide and think about, well, if somebody's in a community, somebody has a 60% heritability factor because of their genes, and then they're never exposed to alcohol, they're not going to have a problem with it. So environment, community norms, accessibility, access is a huge risk factor. And so all of these things come into play when we talk about this. And there's also a very important interaction between the environment that interacts with the genes. When I went to school a long time ago, we actually thought your genes were your genes, and that's what you inherited. Unless there was a major mutation that went on, those were the genes that you had. And the answer is that's still true, except we now know that the environment, literally, your environment can actually turn those genes on or off. And that's an area of research called epigenetics. And it's a fascinating thing. It's actually probably too much for me to understand anymore. It's actually your genes, what your genes do actually can get turned on or off by your environment, by factors in your environment. And so it's not just your genes, it's what's around you. And so that's this complex interaction between genes and the environment. So effects of social stressors on illicit drug use, these are huge. Stressors are one of the number one reasons that people end up taking drugs for one reason or other. They facilitate initiation, they increase the risk of addiction, and they absolutely, stress is one of the number one reasons for relapse once people are in recovery. So what have we learned about other aspects of vulnerability? Well, addictive disorders often coexist with mental disorders, especially in the populations that you all deal with in the criminal justice system. This is, the numbers are astounding, and it's not something that anybody ever looked at in the last 20 years or actually really paid attention to. But comorbidity of mental disorders and addictive disorders are huge, between 30 and 60%, and I would say in your populations, it's more like 60 to 80%. Drug abusers have a concurrent mental health diagnosis, including personality disorder, major depression, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder. So the bottom line is that this is a reality. Many common factors are involved in addiction and mental health. Addiction, early physical or sexual abuse. We know that, in fact, probably 95% of women who end up being addicted have some history of physical or sexual abuse. Stress is an important factor in addiction. Family history, as I said. Mental illness. Peers who use drugs. For mental illness, earlier physical sexual abuse, again, very common. Stress, family history, and drugs and alcohol abuse. So the bottom line is that people always ask me, well, which came first? Is it substance abuse that caused the mental disorder, or is it the mental disorder that caused the substance abuse? Well, there are three theories, and they are the self-medication hypothesis, where substance abuse begins as a means to alleviate symptoms of mental illness such as anxiety or depression, low self-esteem. There's a causal effect. Substance abuse may increase the vulnerability to mental illness. And then the common or correlated causes, life processes, as I showed you in the last slide, and risk factors that give rise to mental illness and substance abuse may be related and overlap. Well, the answer is all three are true. In fact, and that is just what the science says, is that, yes, there are people who become depressed because of their alcohol use, and there are people who actually become alcoholic because of their depression. So it really is all three of these, and we have to accept that comorbidity is a reality, especially in the populations that you work with. So why do people take drugs in the first place? Okay, now I'm going to turn on my nerdy neuroscience hat. Initially, drug use is a voluntary behavior. A person chooses to take drugs for the first time. Initially, a person takes drugs hoping to change their mood, their perception, their emotional state, hoping to change their brain. And how do they do that? Well, so all drugs of abuse end up working on what we call the reward or the reinforcing pathways of the brain. And these are the same pathways that give you normal pleasures or rewards. And one of there, just to be clear, there are many neurotransmitters involved in this system, but one of the main common denominators at the end of the day is how drugs of abuse affect dopamine. But there are glutamate is incredibly important, GABA, endogenous opiates, serotonin. So I don't want to be too simplistic to let you think that this is the only system, but this is the base system. The reward pathways of the brain are mostly driven by dopamine systems. And as you can see, the drugs of abuse work in very specific areas of the brain on this reward system. So we know in combination with many other neurotransmitter systems, and despite the many differences, most abused substances enhance dopamine activity. And so the diagram that we've come up with when I was at the National Institute on Drug Abuse was kind of this diagram, which has been modified a little bit over the years and is a little bit more simplistic than it should be now, but it really boils down the circuits involved in substance abuse into these three different areas. The purple area is memory and learning. That's areas of the brain called the amygdala and the hippocampus. The reward system, again, there's the nucleus accumbens, which is one of the business portions of the reward system where drugs of abuse act. And the green is the motivational system, the orbital frontal cortex, and the inhibitory control system in the blue, the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate gyrus. So the prefrontal cortex is the area right behind your forehead. And what that area does is it's responsible for executive function, decision-making, weighing the risks and positive aspects of any particular kind of behavior. It actually works as kind of the brake in the brain. And so I always use myself as an example, is about inhibitory. What do I mean by inhibitory behavior? So I travel a lot, or used to travel more, but travel a lot, come in the night before, come in, get off the plane, come into the hotel. I'm exhausted. I'm not a young man anymore. But I have a problem with M&Ms. So I often am laying there in bed at 11 o'clock at night saying, oh, I wonder if there are M&Ms in the minibar. All I have to do is get up and go to the minibar and get the M&Ms. And, you know, this, I don't need M&Ms. I don't need M&Ms at 11 o'clock at night or any time because, you know, I have a problem with that. And so, you know, I go back and forth. No, I shouldn't take them. Chocolate, sugar, 11 o'clock at night, you'll be up. Oh, but I remember how good they were the last time. And my motivation is small. All I have to do is get up and go to the mini bar, and I'll have a reward. And my inhibitory control is saying, no, you don't need them, you don't need them. Well, last night I did not have the M&Ms. Why? There are no mini bars in this hotel. Access is a huge issue when it comes to problem behaviors. So I use this example, and my friends who've heard this talk before know that I use myself as this with this example. And it's not that I have an addiction to M&Ms. I don't want you to think that, because I did have a recovering heroin addict come up to me at one of these conferences and yelled at me and said, how dare you compare your M&M problem with the heroin addiction that I got through? And I said, well, I'm sorry, I wasn't really comparing, I was just kind of trying to make a point. He said, you really shouldn't do that. That's really disservice to what I went through. And he said, by the way, if you were addicted to M&Ms, you would have packed them in your bag. He was absolutely right. And so I want to point that out, that in no way is this anything like what people struggle with in addiction. But I use it as an example. So the dopamine pathways, in fact, are very important in the reward system. Again, they go to the striatum, the substantia nigra. And again, as you can see, the nucleus accumbens is part of the business portion of this area, and so of the system. And there are all kinds of different receptors and all kinds of different areas where substances of abuse. And these areas are responsible for rewarding and motivational functions, pleasure and euphoria, motor function, fine-tuning, and compulsion. And if we focus now the microscope down, and you looked at those circuits, you know, now we're going to focus it down and look at the individual brain cells or neurons. And this is what this looks like. This is the soma is called the cell body, and the terminal down at the bottom is how brain cells or neurons communicate with each other. It's called the terminal or the synapse, and it's shown here. So the terminal comes close to the next cell. In this particular case, in this area, it's filled with dopamine in these little vesicles, and there are dopamine receptors on the next cell. So what happens during normal neurotransmission or normal signaling is that the dopamine is released, it binds to the receptor. In the next cell, it stimulates that cell, and that goes on to the next cell, on to the next cell, on to the next cell. And so if this system just had one supply of dopamine release, then one shot, that would be it. It wouldn't work. But Mother Nature, in her wisdom, invented a system called the dopamine reuptake transporter system, which is what is in red there. And that molecule actually scoops the dopamine off of the receptor in that space between the two neurons. There's a reason I'm telling you this. It scoops the dopamine off of that system and then puts it back into those little vesicles so that it's ready for the next signal to come down. So I call it the scooper. And the scooper actually scoops it up. The stuff is released. It's scooped back up so the cell's ready to fire again. And so we know during normal natural rewards, elevated dopamine levels in that area. So if you measure the amount of dopamine in animal studies in that area between those two cells, what could be more enjoyable or more important than food and sex? Food and sex are the two most important natural rewards that we have. We wouldn't be here as a species unless we got some positive reinforcement from both of those activities. These are animal studies now. And so they're measuring the dopamine in that synaptic space. And you can see that food increases dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens in that one. And then when presented with a sex partner in the other one, dopamine increases quite a bit. So again, this is what keeps us going as a species, to have these natural rewards kind of reinforce themselves over and over again. And that's why we're here. So this is a natural reward system. So what we found out many years ago, and we thought this was our biggest finding, is that how do substances of abuse then take over, interfere with this? And we found out that in the turquoise, that cocaine actually would bind to the dopamine reuptake transporter, or the scooper molecule. And this was an amazing finding. We thought, oh, if we could only figure out how to block cocaine from binding to that, it would be a really important medication to develop. And so, as you can see, the dopamine comes out. The scooper's blocking the dopamine from getting reuptake, from the reuptake, so that space is getting flooded with dopamine. You love that space getting flooded with dopamine. That's part, I believe, of the high or the euphoria associated with that. The opiate system's involved here as well. I'm not going to go into that today, but I include it saying that it also is involved in increasing the amount of dopamine in that space via a different mechanism. But if you look in animal studies, the effects of drugs on dopamine release, you look at amphetamines, you can see that there's a huge increase in dopamine release in amphetamine. There also is in cocaine, nicotine, and morphine. They all have different patterns, but they're all higher than the natural rewards in those systems. And so that's why people take drugs, because they love that those areas of the brain flooded with dopamine. Science has generated a lot of evidence showing that prolonged drug use changes the brain in long-lasting and fundamental ways. And I don't talk about brain damage. You'll rarely hear me ever talk about somebody's brain being damaged by drugs, unless it has to do with inhalants, which we know have severe consequences on damaging brain tissue, or people having cerebral vascular strokes, cerebral vascular incidents as a result of cocaine or stimulants. But we don't really know that the brain is damaged by a lot of these drugs. We know that there are changes, there are fundamental changes, and they're long-lasting, but I don't like to talk about damage. And people use that term way too loosely when they talk about people who've used drugs for a long time. There may be damage, but we don't have that evidence. We have evidence for long-lasting and fundamental changes. I'm going to show you what I mean by that. So this is early work by Volkoff and colleagues in 1993. And on the top, this is just looking at overall metabolic activity using PET scans, positron emission tomography. And on the top panel is a normal control. And you can see there's a lot of activity. Yellow is more, and red is more metabolic activity. The second panel is a cocaine abuser 10 days after his last cocaine. You can see it's very different than the normal control. And then that's the last panel is the same individual who was the cocaine abuser, but the same individual's 100 days after his last cocaine. And you can see that, in fact, the overall metabolic activity in these areas of the brain are starting to come back. They're not back to quite normal, but they're, in fact, improving. But that's 100 days. That's a long-lasting and fundamental change, what cocaine did to this individual. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. We know that, in fact, the dopamine 2 receptors, and we don't have to talk a lot about the different kinds of receptors, but we know that this area of the brain that looks like the kidney there is called the striatum, and this is, you know, part of where the reward system is. We know that the dopamine receptors are lower in those areas in people addicted to cocaine versus the normal control, to meth, to alcohol, and to heroin. So I don't have a pointer, but you can see that the red and yellow means more dopamine receptors, and the individuals that are addicted actually have less in those striatal areas. So that's a long-lasting and a fundamental change for all of these drugs of abuse to have in this fundamental system that's involved in our reward-reinforcing pathways. So prolonged drug use changes the brain in fundamental and long-lasting ways. It goes back to this circuitry. It actually impacts the reward system itself. It probably impacts the inhibitory control, the motivation, and I know it also impacts the memory. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And we have evidence that these changes can be both structural and functional. The implication is that brain changes resulted from prolonged drug use may be reflected in compromised cognitive functioning. Well, any of you who work with people, especially individuals who have methamphetamine addiction or problems, you know that their cognitive functioning is severely impaired when they come into your court or they come into your treatment program. So you have to be careful about what kind of treatments you give those individuals versus people who are addicted to other kinds of substances. So, is there recovery? Well, the answer is, of course there's recovery. There's probably many people in this room who are in recovery, and there are millions of people who recover every year from their drug addiction. So the answer is absolutely yes. What do we know about recovery? Not that much. We know a lot about how to get to the addiction, but we don't know as much about what happens in recovery. And we have very little biological data, but this is one of the few sets pieces of data that I know. This is also by Volkoff and colleagues. And this is the dopamine uptake transporter, the DAT molecule. This is the scooper molecule. So again, these are positron emission tomographies, PET scans. And they're showing you how much scooper molecule is in the normal control in that striatum, the kidney-shaped area. Red and yellow is more. And then a methamphetamine abuser, 1 month after his last detox. And that same individual followed out to 14 months. You can see that it's almost approaching what the normal control looks like. That's 14 months. That's, again, a long-lasting and a fundamental change in the reward system of the brain. So, as we've seen, drug use can lead to structural and functional changes in the brain. And so, that leads me to conclude that addiction is fundamentally a brain disease. Addiction is not just a brain disease, however, because if it was and we just figured out the neurochemistry, then everything would be okay and we could go away. But it's not just a brain disease. Addiction is a brain disease expressed as compulsive behavior. Both the developing and recovering from it depend on the behavior and the social context. Well, what does that mean? It means the biology is important, the behavior is important, the environment is important. And so you don't get to just fool around with one of those three and expect to have a positive outcome all the time. So in fact, you have to take all of these things into account. And so what do I mean about this environment? So here's an example. This is a study by Anna Rose Childress. I'm sorry, it's not on the slide. That's from the University of Pennsylvania. And she had the number of cocaine addicts in her treatment program. And she put them in the scanners. Remember that setup I showed you where there was a video in front of the people in the scanners? So this is one of the first studies that showed that. She showed them a video of a neutral video, nature, you know, streams and meadows and Bambi and Thumper, and very natural, very beautiful scene. And then she asked them while they were seeing this video to rate their craving. And as you can see in the neutral, there was no craving. They were enjoying it. It was less than one. But then she showed them a video of cocaine paraphernalia. And in fact, she got intense craving from each one of those individuals. Well, not each one, actually. To be honest, she got it from 12 of the 13, and boy, would I love to study that 13th person. But anyways, she got it from the vast majority of these individuals, and they were craving watching a video of cocaine paraphernalia. Well, remember, she's scanning them at the same time, so she's looking at their brains, and what did she find? Well, she found that the association with this cocaine paraphernalia actually increased the activity in the nature video versus the cocaine video, the nature video on the left, the cocaine video on the right, in these two areas of the brain. She found that these areas lit up. Might not look like lit up, but these are very highly activated areas in the amygdala and the anterior cingulate. And there's no drug involved here. All there is pictures of the paraphernalia associated with someone's drug use. Wow, there's no drug causing this changes in the brain. This is just from video of the paraphernalia. So what does it tell you? Wow, environment's important and memories appear to be a critical part of addiction. They actually can change the activity in your brain. People, places, and things. Bill W. said this about 70 years ago, I think, 75 years ago, and we're just we caught up in the 90s with some of the things from Bill W. said way back when. We caught up with the neuroscience. But in fact, people, places, and things are important. Although we really need to, in fact, to train people with things like resistance skills and coping skills when they're around people, places, and things associated with your drug use. But you can see what they're up against because these things elicit activity in these different parts of the brain. No drug involved, but just the memories of drugs. But it's not just the memories. Drugs essentially are usurping brain circuits and motivational priorities. And what do I mean by that? Well, brain circuits are changing, and motivational priorities change as well. We know that the brain circuitry involved in addiction has similarities to other motivational systems. We already showed you that with the animal studies. But these are human studies. So this is work by Garavan and Stein at the Medical University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And this, they're looking at a different section. They're not looking from the top down. They're looking at a cross-section of the brain. So it's a different way of looking at it. And they're doing scanning. And so what they do here is they're looking at individuals who are controls and individuals who are cocaine users. And guess what? So they're showing them videos of cocaine on the right-hand side there, the cocaine users, those areas of the brain, the cingulate, the anterior cingulate, that was the one Anna Rose Childress had identified, and the inferior gyrus. These areas actually get highly activated, again, by a cocaine paraphernalia video. And these are in individuals who are long-term cocaine addicts. So the controls, nothing when they're shown cocaine paraphernalia. But then they showed them erotic videos. Woohoo! And what happened in the controls? Wow, these areas of the brain lit up like a Christmas tree. In the drug addicts, not so much. Well, what does that tell you? It's not that these areas of the brain are broken. They're actually working. They're activated by cocaine paraphernalia, but they used to work for areas of natural rewards. So just like in the controls, all three of these areas are highly activated by the erotic videos. Again, one of the natural rewards in our society, one of our, species. And so, again, the cocaine addicts, not so much. They had much higher activity related to the cocaine video. That means these areas are active. They're not broken, but they have actually been changed. And the result is what I call motivational toxicity and compulsive drug use. So think about it. It's not as if they don't still love their families, their community. Some people might even love their job. And yet you can see that a natural reward that's built into the system to make sure the species survives, you know, something related to sex, is displacing the circuitry related now to the memory of drugs. This is a big deal. This is motivational toxicity. Of course, their motivation has changed. The circuits have changed. And how the circuits respond to things have changed. And they end up with compulsive drug use. So essentially, the brains have been rewired by drug use. And so the systems that are built in for natural rewards have now been taken over to respond to drugs and memories of drugs. And that's a serious thing. That's a very important aspect. And so, you know, that's why drugs become number one. You saw in the video, in the slide, cocaine addicts, I didn't care so much about the erotic video, but the cocaine video really lit up these areas of the brain. So addiction is the quintessential biobehavioral disorder. And that means the biology and the behavior are so intertwined with the environment that you really have to devote time and energy to all threes. The brains of addicts are different from the brains of non-addicts, and those differences are an essential element of addiction. Doesn't mean they can't be changed back, but because we know people recover all the time, but you've got to start out with the assessment that, from some of the data that I'm showing you here, that you're working with a different circuitry, a different motivational system, and you have to, in fact, work to change that. And so, back to this system, if we talk about the addicted brain, I think it's in the next slide, the non-addicted brain, the inhibitory control is very high, is very strong, the reward system is going, the drive system is ready, the memory system is, you know, just normal. And in the normal brain, if somebody's given the choice of drugs, they might say, nah, the inhibitory control system says it's not good for the organism, it's not good, and in fact, they don't do the behavior. But in the addicted brain, the control system is negated. It actually looks like it's impaired. But the reward system is all juiced up. The drive system is all juiced up. And we know the memory system is loaded with great memories of drugs, of the highs, of drugs of abuse. And so what happens in this individual, that the inhibitory controller, the break in the brain, doesn't prevail, and the motivational system and the reward and memory say, go. Go get drugs, go use drugs, drug seeking and use. And so that's what we think is going on, that the prefrontal control system, in combination with the changes in the other areas, have been altered in individuals with long-term drug use. Well, that brings us to what do we do about that? So we have a variety of effective treatment options in our clinical toolbox, and probably a lot of you know about what these are. Available pharmacotherapies, well, for opiates, which is a very important topic now since we have an opiate epidemic. We have methadone. We have naltrexone, which is a pill form, is an opiate blocker. We have buprenorphine, which is a partial agonist. You may know it as Suboxone, or actually buprenorphine, naloxone is Suboxone. Buprenorphine, you might know it as Subutex. Those are the brand names from one company, but they're available from other companies as well. We also have a new preparation for opiates, not new. It's been around for a while. It's actually one that I'm using in a criminal justice population of opiate use disorder individuals in the Bernalillo County Jail, giving them depot naltrexone, Vivitrol, which is a opiate blocker, and it lasts for 30 days. So in our study, my disclosure should be, I'm getting free medication from the company, Alkabees, but it's an NIH-funded study, so it's not much of a conflict. And so the Vivitrol in our study, we give before release, and then we give six shots over 6 months. And then we follow them for a year. And so the study is ongoing. We're a little past halfway mark. And I, you know, don't have really any data to discuss with you, but this is one of the options. This is for opiate use disorder. Depot naltrexone has been around for a while because it was used originally for alcohol dependence. It is pretty useful in that area as well, as are disulfiram, the pill, oral naltrexone, acompasate. Alcohol withdrawal, nicotine, bupropion, nicotine replacement therapy, varenicline. So we have pharmacotherapies. I'll just point out in the opiates, a brand new formulation on the market is long-acting implantable buprenorphine rods that essentially look like Norplant, and they're actually surgically implanted in individuals, and they can last for 3 months, 6 months, and they actually just slowly deliver buprenorphine to the individual without them having to take daily tablets or film. So that hasn't really caught on yet, and I'm not sure if it will because it's very expensive and it involves a surgical procedure to do the implantation. And so we'll see how that goes. But there are more things on the horizon. I happen to know in the area of opiates, there are long-acting, extended-release buprenorphine preparations, preparations where you give an injection and it lasts for 2 weeks. And these are injections, not implants. Preparations that where you give an injection and it lasts for 4 weeks. So that kind of takes away the need for somebody to be taking a daily a tablet or a daily film. It also takes away the possibility that somebody could divert that tablet or that film if, in fact, they're in a treatment program. So we've got more things coming along, and I think that's really terrific to know. So, but we also have incredible efficacious behavioral treatments for drug dependence. One of the all-time very, very good programs is called cognitive behavioral therapy, and we don't do nearly enough of that. It's a little hard for to learn and to be proficient at, but it's very important. It works very well for a lot of individuals. Community reinforcement with vouchers. CRA actually was partly developed at my organization at CASA at the University of New Mexico with vouchers. Steve Higgins at the University of Vermont added that part to it, and that works very well. Contingency management, which is also very important. And in fact, if you think when I was talking about cognitive effects of methamphetamine, contingency management turns out to be one of the better approaches to help people who are addicted to methamphetamine. Rather than cognitive behavioral therapy, their cognition has been impaired as a result of their drug use. Low-cost contingency management, brief strategic family therapy, multidimensional family therapy, behavioral couples therapy, motivational interviewing, motivational enhancement therapy. Those are also, the last ones are also strategies or treatments that have come out of the work of people like Bill Miller at the University of New Mexico at CASA. And so these are used all over the world. But these are evidence-based practices. They're not all of them, but these are a lot of the evidence-based practices that you should be in the criminal justice system demanding to know what your providers, since you're the customer, what are your providers using to, in fact, treat patients that you're referring to them. And so one size doesn't fit all, and that is very important to remember. So people need to be categorized, assessed, have to figure out what their needs are and what is the appropriate treatment. Tom McClellan, my good friend, always talks about, you know, how important it is to do patient matching and to understand individual patients and what they actually need. And so what happens oftentimes in the treatment system is says, well, I think this person is a good candidate for cognitive behavioral therapy. Oh, great, you get group. And then he goes, I think this person would, you know, really benefit a lot from contingency management. And what do you get? You get group. And so we have a tendency not to give, to treat patients all the same, and they're not. They actually need individual treatment plans, and some work better than the others. So treating a biobehavioral disorder must go beyond fixing the chemistry. We actually have to pay attention to the biology, the behavior, and the social context. The acute care model is what we have traditionally expected in the substance abuse treatment field. As a substance abuse patient comes in, they go into rehab or treatment, they come out, and they're a non-substance abusing patient, and everything's fine. Like a broken leg, you get a cast on it, 10 weeks later, you know, you're out of the cast, or you get an infection, you get a Z-Pak, or 11, 10 days of antibiotics, it's cured. Well, that's the acute care model, and that's the wrong model for substance abuse. It's not an acute care model treatment. It needs a chronic care model, a continuum of care. I used to go down to Capitol Hill and talk to 22-year-old staffers about substance abuse and how treatment can work and prevention, and you'd say treatment works, and their eyes would roll up into the back of their heads. And they and you go, what? And they say, well, I know somebody it didn't work for. Well, of course, we all do. The first time, the second time. It doesn't work for everybody each and every time. It depends on the quality of the treatment, what the treatment is. It depends on the individual. But that's because one bout of treatment isn't necessarily the only way to go. You, in fact, have to do a continuum of care. And this is like what we should be going on in the primary care system, is screening and identification of the individual that needs specialty care, and then a continuous monitoring either by the primary care system or by some kind of recovery services process. So detox is not treatment. It's the beginning of treatment. It's a part of treatment, but it is not a Lexis version of a comprehensive core components of comprehensive treatment services would involve abstinence-based pharmacotherapy, self-help, intake assessment, but also would attend to the medical, mental health, vocational, education, legal, AIDS, HIV, family, child care, housing. In my population that I'm working with, coming out of the Bernalillo County Jail, housing is probably the most important thing for these individuals to have a place. How stressful that is. You don't know where you're going to sleep tonight. And that is one of the biggest stressors for the patients that I work with. So we need to treat the whole person. We need to view and treat addiction as a chronic relapsing disorder. It is. The relapse rates are very similar in drug dependence, 60%, 40 to 60%, as they are, again, relapse rates in type 1 diabetes, in hypertension, and in asthma. And this is an article by Tom McClellan published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, comparing the relapse rates to different chronic relapsing diseases. Here's an example, outcomes in diabetes. This is from Tom McClellan's slide set. If we were a pharmaceutical company and we started off with individuals in our clinical trial who had a very high hemoglobin A1C, 8 or 9 or 10 or something, and then we gave them a medication, put them in the trial, and during the trial, I don't think you want a hemoglobin A1C down as low as 2, but the example is it gets dramatically reduced into a good level, and then they stop the medication, it goes back up. What does the pharmaceutical company say? Wow, that's going to be a blockbuster. It's going to be billions and billions of dollars. What a great medication. So in drug addiction treatment for years, the outcome in addiction is somebody's taking a lot of drugs before they go into treatment. They're in treatment. Their drug use goes way down. They get out of treatment, and it goes back up. And people say, it didn't work. They're using drugs again. It didn't work. And that's the wrong way to look at it. That's the acute care model, not the chronic care model. If we treat a diabetic and symptoms don't subside, what do we do? Would we increase the dose? Would we change the medications? Would we change the treatment approach? Would we fail to provide ongoing treatment for a diabetic? Well, the answer is no, we would not do that. We would not give up. We would try many different things. But in fact, we in this country, and I think we published an article about this a few years back, we still kick about 10% of the programs kick people out of treatment if they have a positive urine. And that's crazy. You don't kick somebody out of diabetes treatment because their blood sugar is too high. You go back and you figure out what the right treatment is for them. So the continuing care model is primary care, specialty care, and then some kind of continuity of care. And we need to keep our eye on the target. When in treating addiction, we need to keep our eye on the real target. Abstinence is always a great goal. It's the gold standard. But what we really want to make sure we focus on is functionality in family, work, and community. And in your case, you want to, in my case too, we want to reduce criminal behavior. I want individuals to be able to function in society, to get jobs, to contribute. I actually want them to be able to contribute into Social Security because I'm getting close to that point where I'm going to need that. And so this is a little selfish, but yes, I want people to have productive lives and jobs so that they can contribute to society. So ineffective systems of addressing drugs and crime. And so this is the last part of the talk. The public health approach is about the disease and the treatment. The public safety approach is about illegal behavior and punishment. Well, we have high attrition in just regular public health treatment programs, and you have high recidivism, rearrest, in the public safety system. But if you combine and blend these systems together, which is what I actually spent a lot of time going around the country talking about, blends the functions of criminal justice and treatment systems to optimize outcome. What do we have? We have community-based treatment. We have opportunity to avoid incarceration or a criminal record. Ah, but we have close supervision and probation. That's important. And we have consequences that are for noncompliance that are, in fact, certain and immediate, such as in drug courts. So the combining of these is very important. I think this is a formula for success to keep people diverted, keep people out of jail who don't belong in jail just because they have a substance abuse problem. If they have criminogenic behavior and or they have, you know, psychopathology, you know, well, they may probably should remain in jail. And, you know, but in fact, just possession or just a substance abuse problem is something we can figure out how to treat. And again, the advantage here over just the community-based treatment is that they have close supervision. And that's a really big plus. So where do we go from here? Wrong one. So advances in science have revolutionized our fundamental views of substance abuse and addiction. The advances have great potential to improve both the criminal justice and the health system approaches to addressing drug abuse and addiction, and nothing could be more important these days with our current opiate epidemic. So I think treatment is the key. It reduces crime, saves money, and improves lives. And that's very important for the individuals who, in fact, we're treating. A new day is here in the field of addictions as a result of the fabulous research that's been going on for the last 20 years. This is, of course, a picture of sunrise from my home in Santa Fe. And so I always, New Mexicans always have to show this. And thank you very much for what you all do.
So Dr. Condon, thank you very much. For colleagues, this is an opportunity for us to ask questions. We have about 10 minutes for a Q&A with Dr. Condon. So does anyone have a question that they'd like to start off with? Dr. Condon, what I will start off with and let the others kind of form their questions is I'm really intrigued by the environmental factors and what we're starting to see in that area. I'm wondering if your studies or if your demonstrations have shown any similarities as to rural versus urban areas or regional geographic?
Yeah, in our studies we haven't, but there are differences. So, you know, in rural areas, it's not the environment as much as it's the provider base that's in short supply. I live in a frontier rural state, which has 2 million people and is the fifth largest geographical state. So you can imagine doing statewide programs, it's incredible. But there are no services. So rural versus urban has a lot to do, in my opinion, with the healthcare system that's available to that, to individuals. And there is data, I think, out there that that criminal justice involved individuals get harsher sentences in rural areas than they do in urban areas. And I don't have that data with me, but in fact, there have been studies that have actually looked at that. The environment. Well, you know, in rural environments, you may or may not have things like self-help or 12-step meetings. Again, I don't poo-poo 12 steps as an adjunct. That's part of this continuum of care. If people go to meetings, people have social interactions with other people in recovery. That's a really important aspect of this, but in fact, it's not treatment in itself. It's just part of that continuum of care. That's all I know about that.
All right, thank you. Representative Williamson.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Condon. Okay. So yesterday we saw a presentation on the gendered impact of the criminal justice system, so the difference between men and women and what women are experiencing, justice-involved women. Often studies, both in medicine and in the criminal justice system, are done on men and then translated to women. I'm wondering what in your work has been done to specifically look at the impact of addiction on women?
Well, there is data, and we know that actually women Again, it goes back to what I said about some of the risk factors. We know that women who are actually become addicted, if you actually do appropriate assessment, you'll find, I don't know, 80 to 90, 100% of them had some kind of sexual or child abuse in their history, some kind of trauma. I mean, it's very potent. It's true with men too, but it's more true actually with women. So one of the approaches to that is what we call, care that pays attention to trauma-relevant care. And so our, individuals who have experienced trauma in their treatment programs don't need this boot camp, you're rotten, that approach doesn't work in a confrontational manner with women, especially women who've had sexual or child abuse. And so we've learned that over the years, that doesn't work as well. That's just not the right way to go about it. In our study, we're actually enrolling women and men in the Vivitrol study, don't have a lot of differences. I am always struck with the women who are coming to our program, our research program, who actually, are just in there for, we have a huge over representation of women in our Bernalillo County Jail. And it's more than it should be. And it's because of things like shoplifting and prostitution, low-level, non-violent things, and they end up in a Bernalillo County Jail because they have this addiction. And so they're doing these low, non-violent crimes and spending jail. So those are the kind of low-risk, high-need individuals that I think we really need to take account of as well.
All right. In the queue, we have Representative Greenlick, Representative Vowell, Senator Manning, and I think there was one other one. So we'll start.
Hi, Tim. Nice to see you again.
Representative.
Nice presentation. Greenlick. When we treat diabetes, we don't have any problem using replacement therapies like replacing insulin that the body is not producing. There's been a fair amount of resistance to replacement therapies in the treatment of substance abuse. Is that beginning to change, and what do we do about that?
I think it is beginning to change. I think the opiate epidemic has made people have to start changing their ideology that you're just substituting one drug for another. Look, some people live way, very productive lives on methadone maintenance. That involves going to the methadone program, in the beginning every day. And so, in our study, ours is a cooperative agreement in a couple of different sites. We have one site that's using methadone in a post-release, pre-release, and post-release. And those individuals have to come to the methadone program every day. But guess what? They're more likely to stay in the study because they're in contact with treatment providers every day. And that's what methadone maintenance. Giving people buprenorphine is very important. It's a partial agonist. People who are opiate tolerant don't get high on it, as you know, Mitch. They just use it to prevent the negative consequences of opiate withdrawal. And it's a very safe medication because it doesn't cause respiratory suppression. Other medications I'm working with, a blocker, that actually seems to be much more popular in criminal justice settings because nobody can get high from it or nobody can divert it. And I'm not sure that's the right way to think about it. But in the last administration, and fingers are crossed what the current administration is going to do, the last administration was very definitive in the Obama administration, especially in the last 2 years, that medication-assisted treatment is, in fact, what should be offered, especially in criminal justice settings, to the point where they said that any federal dollars that go to drug courts can only go to drug courts that offer medication-assisted treatment as an option. So, yes, we're absolutely moving the needle. The opiate epidemic, the crisis, has actually started to change people's minds. Not everybody's, but in fact, I do think, Mitch, we're moving forward with that.
Representative Vile?
I'm curious as to whether any of these programs have been tried in a more controlled environment, not necessarily full incarceration, but lockup or controlled environments, and if so, do they work better when we have a captured patient versus one who's in a more mainstream environment?
Any of these treatment protocols or medication-assisted treatment are you talking about? Well, we, again, at the Bernalillo County Jail where I work sometimes, we have a methadone maintenance program in there, and that actually has been credited with less violence and disruption at the Bernalillo County Jail because people are on methadone maintenance. So that kind of treatment in the jail has worked, actually. So there's been a study that, because I think I was telling this to the judge earlier, one of the Chief Rustin was the warden of the Bernalillo County Jail when I moved to New Mexico, and he decided that methadone maintenance didn't belong in the jail, that it belonged out in the community. And so there was a big hubbub about that. And so there was a study commissioned by the Bernalillo County commissioners to look at this. And what they found was that those who were methadone maintenance not only had less relapse than people not treated when they were released, but they had fewer rearrests as well. So treatment inside the jail, in the captive, if you will, we call our patients free range because we want them to get out and you know, be in their natural environment after they get their first Vivitrol shot. But yes, there are programs. In fact, the Bureau of Prisons, I believe my colleague Kevin Knight in Texas, they're starting a medication-assisted treatment program within the Federal Bureau of Prisons as well. So yes, there are some. I don't have a lot of data on that yet, but we are, again, that goes to what Representative Greenlich said. Are we changing the attitude? Yes, I think we are.
So we have time for two more questions. Senator Manning, followed by Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Chair. Doctor, first off, thank you for this presentation. It's very informative. Learned a lot. My question deals with the area of ethnicity. For example, my youngest son, I'll share this with everyone, my youngest son got hold to some drugs and it took his life. Are there any drugs that are specifically based on ethnicity that differs, or they're all the same no matter who you are? Because this never comes up in the conversation. It seems like only at times we get in this as a bigger picture, but there are rumors and myths out there that says that, well, these drugs will affect a certain ethnic group over others.
Well, that's a tough question. I don't have data on to answer that, but I'll because I'm long-winded, I'll answer it this way. So one of the slides I didn't show is the myths, and I took it out just to shorten the slide deck, but the myths are that communities of color use more drugs, minority communities, than other communities, and the answer to that is no. Those communities are disproportionately impacted by drugs of abuse because of all kinds of other social service issues and poverty and socioeconomic things. But no, except for perhaps Native Americans, and I live in New Mexico now, and we have a higher rate of substance abuse in Native American populations than in Hispanic and Anglo. But no, sir, I don't think there's any, I know of no data that says that a drug of abuse affects one individual different than another, except on an individual basis, but not on an ethnicity basis. So again, some people can take drugs and never get addicted, and some people get addicted right away. There was one instance during the methamphetamine epidemic, as you probably remember, where African-American communities really didn't get involved very much with the methamphetamine epidemic. It was white males, 18 to 35 years old, a lot of them in rural environments, and nobody actually could quite figure out. So it wasn't as if methamphetamine was less rewarding in African-Americans, because Nora Volkoff actually went and did a study trying to figure this out. It was more of a sociological issue, is that we're not getting back into that crack cocaine, because crack cocaine had an incredible impact in the communities of color in this country. And that wasn't because they were just using more, it was because of the consequences that came about of that. So I don't know of any data that says You know, drugs are more potent for one ethnic group versus another.
I really like the continuing care model. And in Oregon, we have coordinated care organizations that are providing services to our Medicaid population. And we are trying very hard to integrate mental health and drug and addiction services into the whole system of care for our Medicaid population. I think the problem we're having is developing a matrix for mental health and for drug addiction, as well as, well, figuring out what are the outcome measures that we can give these coordinated care organizations so that we can see how can we measure the successes for whatever program a coordinated care or a patient has in trying to overcome the drug addiction. Is there any research out there on outcome measures, matrix?
There is research out there on outcome measures, and actually some of it comes out of the group in Chicago at the Lighthouse or Chestnut and Lighthouse organizations. They have studied longitudinally populations, individuals, and looked at outcomes, and they actually also do adolescents as well. So the answer is yes, there's data out there, research about what the outcomes might and should be. I can't actually quote that to you off the top of my head. But in fact, one of the things that has become very clear is that, and when I moved to New Mexico, I was kind of shocked because it's a very poor state, but they actually, Medicaid pays for peer recovery support specialists. Pardon me? And I said, wow. I said, who was asleep when this passed somebody's desk and they signed off on it in the Medicaid office? And so that's a very important aspect of these community services that, because we have those in New Mexico also. And there is a certification program for peer support recovery specialists, and it's a very important aspect of that. It improves the outcome, whether it be abstinence or functionality.
Dr. Condon, thank you again for your presentation. We're going to be taking a short recess of about 10 minutes to allow people to get stretch and do what you might need to do in the 10 minutes. We will be gaveling back in. We want to stay on time with the other two presenters and then also the lunch that we'll have for us with the legislators. Thank you very much, and we'll see you back in 10 minutes.
Okay, everybody got their caffeine? Ready to come back in? Take a seat. We are ready to roll. There comes the silence. Thank you, everybody. All right, we're ready to dive into our third speaker. But first, for our second speaker, excuse me, first for introduction, I would like to pass the baton back to Senator Przanski.
Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and just kind of do a little official thing here. We'll call us back to order for all four of the committees. It's now our opportunity to welcome a formerly incarcerated advocate for social justice, Mr. Khalil Cumberbatch. Spent 7 years in the New York State prison system. Since his release in 2010, he has been working with the underserved and marginalized communities that have negatively been impacted by mass incarceration. He now serves as the manager and trainings at the Just Leadership USA, a nationally nonprofit dedicated group to cutting the U.S. corrections population in half by the year 2030. So, Mr. Cumberbatch, thank you very much for being here, and please welcome him.
Thank you, Senator. It's always a bit awkward when someone is reading your bio and you're not that far away. I feel like Martin Luther King when he came up and he said, I wanted to know at one point who they were really talking about. So thank you so much for inviting me. I want to thank the organizers for getting me here from literally across the country and making this process really easy for me to stand here today in front of you and to share my story very briefly. As the senator said, I am Khalil Cumberbatch, the manager of trainings at a national not-for-profit called Just Leadership USA, which was founded by a national advocate around criminal justice and social justice issues named Glenn Martin. The goal of our organization is to cut the U.S. correctional population in half by the year 2030. And we are not fooled to believe that if we were to actually do that, that we would somehow fix the system and right wrongs. But it was a way for us to push the field in general, to move away from incrementalism, to move away with the contentment of complacency and incrementalism, and to shock the field, to do something more bold and audacious. And I would argue and say that on some respects, we've already done that. We plan to get to half by 2030 by empowering those who are directly impacted by the criminal justice system to lead criminal justice efforts. The slogan of "No More About Us, Without Us" is a good way to really summarize that goal. And if we thought about other fields and other movements and other reform efforts, we would never have a conversation now around a particular issue without having those who are directly impacted by that issue intimately involved in the conversation, not just having a seat at the table, but actually having say-so in what was actually being talked about at the table. And if we used the issue of women's reproductive rights or LGBTQ rights, those are just two very easy examples to look at and see how those fields have understood the importance of having those voices directly impacted. And at Just Leadership USA, we've currently trained over 222 formerly incarcerated and or criminal justice involved leaders from across the country, 26 different states, including Oregon and including D.C., and we look at those leaders as the folks who are going to help to impact change in their local areas, whether it's on a state level or local municipality, or even on a federal level, to actually help us get to the ultimate goal of half by 2030. I also have the distinguished honor of being a lecturer at Columbia School of Social Work. I teach a class around mass incarceration, it's a graduate level course, and I myself, who grew up in a neighborhood where higher education was something that I, at one point in my life, deemed to be unattainable, actually find it very humbling that I'm in one of the oldest social work institutions in the country. But I don't come here today really wearing those monikers proudly. The one that the senator opened up with, and he talked about my criminal justice involvement, is what I actually come here today to talk to you about and with those lens. I served 6.5 years in the New York State prison system. And anytime that I talk and I share my story and I share my experience and I talk about the work that I'm doing, that doesn't really get people really to pay attention. But the point that I say that I had served 6.5 years in the New York State prison system, that's the moment that folks kind of like perk up and pay attention, and I can see body language shift. Because what that means is that I don't look like someone who's been formerly incarcerated. And I've been told that many, many times throughout the course of my career. And the question that always comes to my mind is, well, what does a person who is formerly incarcerated really look like? And the answer to that is largely wrapped around racial issues. It's largely wrapped around socioeconomic issues. But the reality is that I stand here today in front of you as someone who may not look like I have had criminal justice involvement, but yet and still I have been formerly incarcerated. And it shapes the analysis that I have of not only the system in general, but also policies that are impacting communities of color. Because I come from firsthand experience. And it's not to minimize second or tertiary experience, but it is to say that it is quite different when someone is talking about the conditions in jails and prisons and a person has actually served time in jails and prisons. And again, I don't mean to minimize any of our colleagues in the field who have not had criminal justice involvement. But the same way that I would talk to a judge about law and listen very keenly because of their direct experience is the way that I hope that today you would listen to me with a level of attention, largely based around my direct impact by the criminal justice system. So as mentioned, I flew in all the way from New York, and boy, are my wings tired. We've all heard that joke. I'm gonna let that sit for a little while. but I come from a neighborhood in New York City called Southside Jamaica, Queens. And if anyone has ever heard of Southside Jamaica, Queens, I'm pretty sure that you've not heard of it in a positive context. It is one of seven neighborhoods in New York City, which are five counties or boroughs out of 62 in New York State, that feed almost 70% of the New York State prison system. And I think that that's important for context, because we're talking about neighborhoods that if you were to remove labels, if you were to look at them, pictures of those neighborhoods, or looked at it from an aerial view, you wouldn't necessarily be able to distinguish which neighborhood is which. And what I'm trying to say is that those neighborhoods have the same makeup of people. They have the same makeup of commerce. They have the same makeup of stores, housing projects, police presence, drugs, teenage pregnancy, high infection rates of HIV and AIDS, Hep C, so on and so forth. And that's not to say that these communities have any role to play in any of that. Well, the community members in those communities have roles to play that largely dictate how those communities are. What I am saying is that these are neighborhoods that have historically and continue to be socioeconomically deprived and marginalized. Schools are underfunded. Employment opportunities are scarce. Outside commerce is common. And these are just communities that, for the most part, have been heavily impacted by drug epidemics. And Southside Jamaica, Queens is no exception to that. In the mid to late 80s, Southside Jamaica, Queens was a neighborhood that was known for its rampant abuse of the drug known as crack. And we all know, and we could speak at length about what the crack epidemic has done to communities of color and to other communities across the country. So I'm gonna spare us that part. But I am gonna say that when I moved into Southside Jamaica, Queens in the early 90s, it was on the tail end of this war on crack and the war on drugs, all the way from a federal level all the way down to a local level. And growing up in that neighborhood and walking in that neighborhood and you know, playing and having friends in that neighborhood, it became commonplace for you to see activity that you knew as a young child was illegal, but yet and still it was normalized in many respects. And growing up, you start to believe that that's actually normal. And you start to believe that if this is happening to you, then it must be happening to other people across the country. And within that context, you start to see things like older people or people older than you, people that you may look up to, people that you may idolize in some sense, as it is easy for young children to do, to be arrested and to go to prison and then to be released without any real efforts to reform them or to give them the resources that they need to actually make a living for themselves and their families. And then they go right back to do exactly what it was that got them to prison and jail in the first place. And then that becomes normalized. And all of the activity that comes with that becomes normalized. And for me, growing up in that environment, it became very normal for me to carry a firearm. And because of my experience growing up, you know, I realized at a very young age that the power of a firearm is one that it's scary in many respects. The first time that I've learned the power of a firearm and how it can change someone's behavior was when I had one stuck in my face at a very young age. So growing up in this neighborhood that was tough for many reasons, carrying a firearm was something that I ultimately ended up doing. And ultimately that led me to commit a robbery of two white women in New York City, Park Avenue and 96th Street. And it's not necessarily what we took that landed me in state prison, but it was who we took it from. If anyone knows anything about New York City, Southside Jamaica, Queens is very much different from Park Avenue and 96th Street. And the judge punished us because we were four black and brown children leaving our neighborhood, Southside Jamaica, Queens, and coming to a nice part of New York City to commit a robbery. And ultimately, I ended up with an 11-year prison sentence and served ultimately 6.5 years of that. Came home in 2010 and began my reentry as someone who, one, did not want to go to prison, and two, wanted to create a different legacy for myself and my children. I wanted my children at one point in their life to look back on the legacy that their father left and be proud of who he was. And I felt like the day I left prison, had I died, that legacy would have not been that. And I worked really, really hard to rebuild myself. I successfully completed community supervision, and I started a graduate-level program, which means that I completed an undergraduate-level program, started a family and got married and was an engaged community member, and was home for about 4 years when, on May 8th, 2014, Immigration Customs Enforcement came to my home 7 o'clock in the morning to arrest me because of the criminal conviction that I had had up until that point more than a decade ago. And based on the fact that my mother and I migrated here as legal permanent residents from my native country of Guyana. Fast forward, I was held in immigration detention for 5 months and was ultimately released when the government decided that everything that I had done in the previous 4 years of my life warranted me being released and my deportation, my almost imminent deportation, to be put on hold. And unlike my incarceration of 6.5 years, the 5 months that I endured in immigration detention came at a very different point in my life. I had two young children. I had, had stake in the community and knew that what was happening to me was not only happening to me, it was happening to my family, particularly my two young children. The day that I was released from immigration detention, October 10th of 2014, my oldest daughter was there at the courthouse. And when I walked out of the courthouse and she hugged me and she told me that she had forgiven me because she was struggling with this idea that bad people go to jail and good people don't, and daddy is a good person, but yet and still he was in jail. And it was something that she struggled with for quite some time, even after my release from immigration detention, so much so that she would even say sometimes that when she saw the police, that she would say, you know, I hope that they don't arrest you again and take you to jail. And I say all this to say that when we talk about the impact of the war on drugs on communities of color, we cannot only look at that issue as if it has passed. We cannot only look at that issue and say, well, that was an issue that we did during the Clinton administration, or maybe it was during the Reagan administration, or maybe it was started, or maybe it did start with Nixon and the Southern Strategy. Maybe it was all of that. And we could easily be fooled to believe that that is not currently an issue that has residual effects on multiple generations. Here I am, someone who stands before you to say that I have never been convicted of a drug offense. But yet and still, I have been the victim of some of the impacts of the war on drugs and the crack epidemic that decimated a community that I ultimately moved into well over 6 years after the epidemic would, quote unquote, be officially called as ended. And now I stand here in front of you as a father who is continuously mending the wounds of two young women, will ultimately be women, because of my absence, because of a conviction that I got, because growing up in a neighborhood, I believed that carrying a firearm was something that was right. And I don't want it to get lost in my message that I am somehow placing all of the blame at the feet of the system. But what I'm saying is that when you give folks two evils to choose from, in the end, they will always choose the lesser of those two evils. But nevertheless, they are still two evils. And I want you to hear me loud and clearly that I take ultimate responsibility for any decisions that I've made that have led me both to prison and everything that has happened afterwards. But does not mean that some blame is to be placed at the feet of the system. And the system is a term that I use very sparingly. And some people would argue, including myself, that the system actually includes some of the people in this room. And it's not a negative connotation, but I am saying that you are in a place, in a position, to actually help to impact change. And that you are indeed the exact folks that I should be sharing my story to, because while it is great to preach to the choir, nevertheless, they are the choir and they are already the converted. And I'm not suggesting that anyone in this room is not the converted, but I'm saying that it is always good to hear the message about the impact that a system that we engage with on a daily basis and sometimes even get lost in the monotony of that system, what the real impact are. That when we talk about mass incarceration and we use numbers like 2.3 million people in some jail, prison, or detention center across the country, that we are talking about people. That we are talking about people like Khalil. And that we are talking about 2.5 million children who have identified as having a parent incarcerated. And we are talking about an estimated 65 to 100 million people with some form of a criminal record in some repository across this country. And that when we look at it from that perspective, we start to understand the immediacy and the urgency of why we need to reform a system as soon as possible, and that we must not be complacent with incrementalism. And while it is great to see that we have achieved some goals, the reality is that we are far from where we would all call a true justice system, one that holds folks accountable but also gives them everything that they need to not relapse, to not make decisions that would lead them to a jail or prison cell, to not have to make decisions that they deem as the lesser of two evils. That when we talk about 660,000 people leaving a jail or prison a year, that we're talking about men and women, and in some cases children, who will be returning to some of the counties that some of us work in very diligently. And I urge you to keep that in mind as you move forward, because some of us do the work from a 10,000 feet in the air perspective, aerial view, so to speak. And while that work is needed, it is very easy to get lost in the idea of that we're talking about men and women and children, community members, and the decisions that we make will have generational impact, in some cases, multi-generational impact. And I just want to share with you one quote by a man named John L. Richman, who, for the folks in the room who may not know, was a top aide to Richard Nixon, both during his presidential campaign and after he won the presidency. And it was recently that he was quoted as saying that the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies: the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or to be against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, then criminalizing both heavily, both meaning marijuana and heroin, we could disrupt those communities, we could arrest their leaders and raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. Some people would say that this idea of the war on drugs began with the Nixon administration, and that it began with this idea of being tough on crime and tough on drug addiction. Ultimately, what turned out to be coined and termed as the Southern Strategy, we now hear from one of the chief strategists in that administration that this was very intentional, that we in this room are dealing with the residual effects of what people concocted in a room to be let loose on communities of color who did not know that any of this was coming, and that their only crime, so to speak, was being against the war or being black. Again, I say this and I share this to not place blame at anyone's feet, but to show you that there is context into what we are currently battling with. And if we are fooled to believe that because we have a Democratic or Republican president in office that some things can and cannot be done, the reality is that we cannot be complacent with that. That even in the face of oppression and tyranny, we must double down on our rhetoric and our values as Americans to believe that the change that we want to see in the criminal justice system and other systems is one that can happen, but sometimes we need to also believe that it must happen. Because all too often, we fool ourselves to believe that although it can happen, that now is not the time. That we could just wait until another administration comes in office, or maybe we should just wait until the next midterm election. But the reality is, we, the people in this room, are responsible for what will happen, what our story will be 50 years from now, the same way that we look back on the civil rights era and we ask ourselves, where were the good people in this fight? The same will be asked about us, and I don't know about you, but as I mentioned at the top of this talk, that I want one day my legacy to be that I was one of the good people, that I was one of the people who fought despite what the odds were, and that that ultimately got us to a finish line that may not be the end of the race, but it will signify the end of one leg of a long journey. So I thank you for inviting me here, for hearing my story, and for ultimately the work that you do on a daily basis. It's very important for us at Just Leadership USA to understand that it's not just the folks on the East Coast or middle of America, but it is folks in Oregon doing work to help reform the criminal justice system. So I want to thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Cumberbatch, for being here. It's wonderful to hear your story and your perspective. We do have some time for some questions. I will, I guess, pose the first one, maybe one that seems to be obvious based on your statements.
Sure.
Knowing the history does repeat itself, do you see similarities from the Nixon era and therefore forward to the rhetoric that we've heard from the current president through his campaign and now the starting of his administration?
Yeah. So, you know, I work at a non-for-profit, right? So I have to be bipartisan in my answer. yes, I mean, we can clearly see that there is overlapping rhetoric. The current president actually has made the statement that he is the law and order candidate, making it very clear that rhetoric was something that he was going to transplant. And ultimately, you know, law and order rhetoric and those terms are really dog whistle politics and really ways to really talk about how you're going to implement policies that are going to undoubtedly have negative impacts on black and brown communities. So yes, I do see overlap in that. But also I would urge us to be very open to the idea that that although a candidate may say that in his rhetoric, that we can also argue and say that there have been Democratic presidents who have used rhetoric very similar, and more importantly, that their actions have shown quite the opposite to what many people would associate as being the values of the Democratic Party. So, for example, I will say that President Obama, although he's done many things to help the field of criminal justice reform and even using the term mass incarceration in his public talks, has been very helpful to change the ongoing rhetoric around the folks who are being impacted by the system. The reality is that he also left the office as being the deporter in chief, a moniker that was given to him for deporting more people than any other sitting president ever. It was under the Clinton administration that we saw the implementation of what we now know as the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, which also had parts built into it that largely expanded the category that we now call, in terms of immigration policy, aggravated felony. So I say to say, although, yes, we do see a lot of overlap in the current administration and past administrations, that even after this administration ends, we can't be fooled to believe that if we can just get a Democrat in there, then everything will be all right. Because the reality is that, you know, history has shown us that that the minute that we say that is we are susceptible to policies being implemented that are actually contrary to what our goals are.
Thank you. Representative Knowles.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Cumberbatch, what sort of policy suggestions would you have for us as lawmakers, or what things would you ask that we examine so that we can help make progress toward your organization's goal?
Yeah, thank you for the question. As a judge, at least how I understand it, you have to take all matters into consideration before you sentence a person, meaning familial ties, community ties, any work experience, anything along those lines. I think what would be helpful is, I think sometimes we look at someone's story and their life and we can tell that they haven't been given many opportunities. I would like to see in my organization, what we strive to see is judges who use the full discretion that they have to maybe delay a case for 6 months. Maybe a person is willing to take a plea deal of guilty, and sentencing could be pushed back to 6 months. But in the meantime, give that person stipulations that they should fulfill in terms of enrolling in community college, in terms of linking them to services that would be helpful for them to transition either out of a current living situation that they have into a better one, or maybe from a current employment situation that they have or don't have into a better one. So I guess my answer is that utilizing the full resources that you have available to you to not necessarily just deem how much jail time is exactly the right punishment for this person, but saying, what resources does this person need that ultimately when they go into the jail system that they would have some resource or they have some experience and or resources available to them once they leave the jail and prison system?
Other questions? Mr. Cumberbatch, thank you very, very much for your time. We really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
So. So this moves us into our third presenter for the morning. This will be Judge Frederick A. Block. It's our opportunity here at the What's Work Conference to have an individual who is cutting edge in his field as to looking at some of the unintended consequences. The Honorable Judge Frederick Block was appointed to the U.S. District Judge at the Eastern District for New York, and also sits in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on panels. Judge Brock caught the attention of many people this last year with a remarkable decision that he handed down which detailed the ways of our justice system impacts ex-cons, and what he is calling for is reform and asking us to rethink collateral consequences. So please welcome Honorable Judge Brock.
I made it up here. Thanks for telling me my middle name is A. I love that label, but it's not A, and it's not Z. It's just Frederick Brock. My parents had no imagination whatsoever. I hope their son did better, though, in the course of his lifetime. You know, so I'm here to talk about collateral consequences. And when I wrote this decision called Nesbitt, I had no idea what the collateral consequences would be by reason of the fact that a judge from Brooklyn put pen to paper and write about this important subject matter. But I must tell you before I say anything about that, I've had some wonderful collateral consequences as a result of that decision. I never realized I'd be invited to speak here today. My hat's off to all that you do here to make the law relevant and to examine it and to continue to do the wonderful things you do to be open-minded about what can we do to constantly improve our criminal justice system. Another set of collateral consequences which I'm happy to report on is the wonderful reception and the care and attention myself and Mrs. Brock have been given by Julie and by Tiffany and by Mike Schmidt and all you wonderful people who have made our trip across the United States and our stay in Portland and here very memorable. So these are personal collateral consequences, and I just want to start my comments by thanking all of you who have given me the opportunity to be here today. Now, I'm also here to give you a little bit of a confession. I'm in my 23rd year as a federal district court judge in the Brooklyn courthouse. And for almost all of that period of time, neither myself nor any of my colleagues ever once spoke and thought about the collateral consequences that attach to people who have been convicted of a felony at the time that we sentence this person to jail, probation, whatever. We know generally that there's a degree of difficulty when somebody has been incarcerated, like the prior gentleman who spoke to you, or anybody who has a felony conviction, in getting employment and making on with his or her life. But the magnitude of all of this, the specificity of it, the degree, the dimension of these collateral consequences is something which I felt was lost upon the judiciary, lost upon the bar. So I evolved over the years by thinking a little bit about what it is when we better sentence people and what their lives are like as a result of the sentences that we impose. And I was motivated, actually, by Michelle Alexander's book in 2010, The New Jim Crow. So I read that, and it was a polemic. And it's not that I necessarily agree with everything that Professor Alexander wrote, but she did focus my attention on the fact that we have now, in our post-incarceration world, these enormous, enormous, what we call hidden sentences that we are not aware of, that basically attach to people who are convicted of a felony. So I started to, as a matter of curiosity, wonder really what they are. We spoke in terms of generalities, but the specifics were really lost on me. The lawyers who came before me for sentencing would do an excellent job talking about the nature of their clients' lives and this and that, but no one ever really focused upon the degree, the dimension, the quantity, the quality of these so-called consequences or hidden sentences that we now refer to them that attach as a result of a felony conviction. And there are a lot of people in the United States that are walking around with felony convictions. The last numbers I looked at show that over 15 million working age people have felony convictions. So it's something that really deals with the fabric of our whole society and our criminal justice system. So after I read Professor Alexander's book, I said, well, what are these all about? The ABA came down with a study which shocked me, and I don't know whether it shocks you. They actually created the data bank that showed that statewide in the United States, there are approximately 50,000 collateral consequences that attach to somebody who is a convicted felon. 50,000. Under federal law, there's about 1,300. Now, I don't know what they all are. I have no idea. Lawyers don't know what they all are about. But then we go about and we sentence people to jail. So the thought struck me, I cannot legislate change. It may be even awkward for a federal court judge to dare to say to the legislators here what they should do, but I'm going to do it anyway, because I think that judges have an obligation to share with the public things that they learn about as a result of, you know, sitting on the bench, not to keep it in pectora, because otherwise there's no possibility for awareness. And if there's no awareness, there's no knowledge, and there's no possibility for improving our criminal justice system, and I think we're all here in this room committed to doing exactly that. So I became curious about all of that. And I wondered to myself, I know that when I sentence somebody under federal law, we are required to consider the circumstances of the crime, what kind of crime that person committed, and the personal characteristics of the defendant. Sentencing is a very much an individualized thing. It's not one shoe fits all. So we're obliged to do that. Well, I wondered whether or not the courts have been really doing that when it comes time to considering the life that people will be living after they get out of jail. So I did some research. And the 6th, 7th, 11th circuits have pretty much turned down, it seems to me, considerations of collateral consequences when it comes to going about sentencing somebody. Should it impact the sentence that you render? The 7th, 11th Circuit said no to that. We don't think there should be a discount for people who are wealthy and have done well, et cetera, et cetera. But happy to say my circuit court, the 2nd Circuit, in that covers New York and Vermont and Connecticut, in 2009, Judge Chin, writing for this circuit, just in passing made a reference to the fact that he didn't believe that you can calibrate a just punishment if you do not, as a sentencing judge, consider the collateral consequences that that person will face once they leave my courtroom. And that caught my attention. And that, plus Michelle Alexander's book, started to get me to evaluate, just like you do here, when you evaluate and reevaluate where we're at with our criminal justice system at any given point in time in our society. So I checked to see what the 9th Circuit did. Nothing written in the 9th Circuit by a district court judge, by a circuit court judge, addressing the issue of whether a sentencing judge should or could consider collateral consequences. So there we had pretty much a blank slate. Then along came Nesbitt, Michelle Nesbitt. And I sat there when she was convicted of bringing 603 grams of cocaine into the country in a suitcase. She went to Jamaica. She had a boyfriend. She was convicted. She cried in my courtroom. We had to carry her out of the courtroom. She was hysterical. And I had to sentence her. Then I realized that this could be the case that perhaps I can further the dialogue by writing a little bit more specifically about collateral consequences. So Ms. Nesbitt was 20 years of age. She had a stellar record, an American citizen. She was an A student in college in her second year in Connecticut. She had worked for years as a counselor to young children, she was studying to become not only a teacher, but hopefully a principal. And she had an inexcusable bad hair day when she went to Jamaica to visit her grandparents. The jury did not believe that she didn't know about it, but she said that, you know, she didn't realize that her boyfriend put some drugs in the suitcase, and I think she was justly convicted. Nonetheless, the jury spoke. We honored the jury's verdict, and it came time to sentence her. And she was an exemplary citizen in the highest order, a top student. She had just a bright future. Now she no longer has that bright future. So I started to take a look at what to do. And I gave the probation department a homework assignment, and I gave the defense lawyer a homework assignment, and I gave the government prosecutor a homework assignment. Let me know specifically what collateral consequences Charlene Nesbitt faces now that she's been convicted and she's going to be sentenced by Judge Block. And they reported back to me, and it was illuminating. So here's what they told me. Both the government, the probation office, in the PSR, I had the probation department amend the pre-sentence report to include a section called collateral consequences. That had never been done before. And my colleagues, you know, had no clue as to what the specific collateral consequences were of anyone that was being sentenced. So here's what they reported back to me, that under federal law, Ms. Nesbitt was ineligible for grants, loans, work assistance for 2 years, the duration of a college career. She was receiving student loans to get by school. She was no longer going to be entitled to do that anymore. Precluded from having professional commercial licenses from U.S. agencies for up to 1 year. Social Security benefits, no. Food stamps, she needed them, no. Revocation of driver's license for 6 months. That really caught my attention. Here's somebody who wants to get on with her life, has to go to work and is not allowed to drive for 6 months. What's the correlation? What's the rationale for that? It just puzzles me. No entitlement to relief for disaster. I don't know whether or not Hurricane Sandy, you know, had any impact upon her home, but if it did, she could not get any benefits from that. Can't serve as a juror. She and her family could be denied public housing, ineligible for passport during her probationary period, et cetera, et cetera. Now, she's going to be followed in Connecticut. The probation department there will be supervising her probation, sentenced to 1 year probation. So Connecticut law is impacted, just like Oregon law would be impacted if we had somebody living in Oregon who was convicted in felony court. So under Connecticut law, she can't vote while on probation, can't serve on jury for 7 years, can't receive teaching certificates for 5 years, and forever in the discretion of the State Board of Education, cannot adopt a child for 5 years, may be ineligible for public housing. Wow. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but what an eye-opener. So the whole idea and the concept, I thought, that judges ought to be aware and mindful of the collateral consequences facing anybody who's been sentenced by them, I thought was paramount. I thought it was important. That gave birth to my writing the Nesbitt decision and the wonderful collateral consequences that followed. It got a lot of national attention. And I think it's been an eye-opener, hopefully, an awareness for judges, for prosecutors, for the probation department, et cetera, to be more sensitive about really what we're doing when we sentence somebody to jail and what a true punishment is, because the person is punished for the crime they commit in terms of the incarceration or whatever, but they're also punished severely for what happens after their sentence is completed. And I thought that we must have a dialogue and an awareness and pay some attention to all of this. Now, it's not just an idle conceptual thing. In the EDNY now, we have probation people out here. Our probation department has to have a section in the PSR that's called collateral consequences. The judge, in his or her discretion, can do what he or she wants, but at least they have to be made aware of the realities of what their sentences are all about in terms of the totality of how it impacts the person that they're sentencing. 10 days from now, on February 27th, you may or may not know this, there's going to be an argument in the United States Supreme Court in the case of Patchington versus the state of North Carolina. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers has written a terrific amicus brief, and it's all about collateral consequences. Why? Because this was a sex offender case. I don't have a lot of empathy for sex offenders. I'm sure a lot of you are concerned about these types of things. There's sex registries that they have to be a part of, but there's also a statute, a collateral consequence statute in the state of North Carolina that requires anybody who is on the sex registry to access any social networking website at all for those that might use it, who might be under 18. Well, that's everybody, right? No social networking website if you're on the sex registry in North Carolina. The defendant was convicted of a felony for violating that collateral consequence after this person was out of jail, for posting a message on Facebook praising God for the dismissal of a traffic ticket. Believe it or not, that case is going to be argued February 27th in the United States Supreme Court, and the certified issue is whether or not barring the use of social media websites by sex offenders violate the First Amendment. Now, if the amici have their way, they're encouraging the Supreme Court to write about collateral consequences. And maybe next year at this time, you'll have some of the justices of the Supreme Court speaking to you instead of a lowly district court judge from Brooklyn. But they are going to hopefully be, for the first time, ask themselves the question, oh, wait a second, there's got to be some correlation, some relationship between these collateral consequences and what you're trying to accomplish as a society. And a lot of these obviously would violate the Constitution. Now, this is the first batter up as to whether this particular collateral consequence violates the First Amendment. I think it's going to be opening up the door to a lot of this. I think you're going to have more and more conversations at meetings like this about all of that. So naturally, since I was invited, happily so, to come to Oregon with my wonderful wife, Betsy, to come speak to you today, I thought, as a hopefully conscientious judge, I should take a peek and find out what the Oregon collateral consequences are that you have here in this room today. And I, you know, don't have a list of every thousand one, but I have them broken down because I have a very good law clerk who tells me this is what it is. You have 709 collateral consequences in the state of Oregon affecting employment opportunities, 709. You have 18 affecting government benefits, 154 affecting civic and political participation, 44 affecting housing. Now look at some silly ones, just to trigger your thoughts a little bit here, about how important it is to take a hard look at what you're doing here, let alone through the rest of the country. For controlled substantive offenses, you have 196, including, believe it or not, if you are guilty of a controlled substance offense, you cannot ever be a black bear cougar agent for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Did you know that? That's an important collateral consequence. That should stay in the books forever. Any felony triggers the following, 400 some odd. Can't be a court interpreter, even if you speak 17 languages. Can't be a massage therapist. That may not be a bad idea. I don't know. Can't be a telemarketer. Can't receive free, appropriate public education. Can't be denied apartment rental by a landlord. So we can go on and on. You get the idea about the degree of difficulty that somebody who is saddled, the 15 million people, with a felony conviction face that we don't even know about when we come time to sentencing them. So we know there's a great correlation. There's statistics all over the ballpark about the degree of difficulty in getting employment. There's one Illinois study that struck me recently. They documented only 8% of people employed for a year recidivists, compared to the state average of 54%. There are statistics all over the place that clearly correlate the inability for people to get employment and the recidivist rate that we have. And it costs us a fortune, and it's counterproductive, and it doesn't help society. We want people to work. We want them to pay taxes. We don't want to have to pay $30,000 a year, which is the current cost to incarcerate somebody in a federal penitentiary. So what can be done? What can be done? Well, last year there was an executive order. We're big on executive orders the last couple of years. And the past president issued an executive order banning the box, meaning that the federal employers can't do that in the first instance when somebody's applying for a job, but can, of course, inquire later on during the interview process. 24 states have done that since the executive order was signed by the president in 2015, including, happily so, the state of Oregon. I don't think, I'm going to be a little critical of Oregon in a second too, so hold your applause. I don't think that that's nearly enough, but it's at least conceptually something in the right direction. Doesn't mean you have to employ somebody who has a felony conviction, but you have to give them a fighting chance to at least be interviewed and to speak. But jobs are the key. Are we doing enough to find employment for people who are saddled with the burden of not being able to get employment in the regular workforce because of their felony convictions? You have to have people have hope. You have to give them employment. We know the statistics. We know the correlation. Is the state of Oregon, the state of New York, the state of Connecticut, all of us, are we doing enough to really see to it that people are having an employment opportunity? Do we have state agencies in Oregon, for example, that really take the lead and the responsibility to getting people employment? It's not an easy thing to do, but I think that the state can serve a terrific, terrific responsibility here. I mean, there are highways to be repaired. There's work to be done. And I think that it's something that maybe is worthy of thought. Are you doing enough as a state to facilitate people to be employed after they have received a felony conviction? Now, in 2010, we have in the country a wonderful organization called the Uniform State Law Commission. And its mission, and they consist of commissioners from every state in the country, a lot of professors, a lot of people who are like people in this room, and they draft uniform proposed legislation in all sorts of areas of the law. And in 2010, they enacted the Uniform Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act. I have a copy of it. It has 10 or 11 different aspects to it. And it does what you would think would be logically done. You take a hard look at these felonies. You take a hard look at the collateral consequences. You see whether or not there can be expungements after a period of time. There's a whole host of suggestions that have been codified in this Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act. And it's something which is really worth taking a look at. Now, Oregon happily has done so. And it was introduced in your legislature in 2015. The senator probably knows about it. It never got out of Ways and Means Committee for reasons I don't know, and it's bogged down. I think you ought to take a real hard look at whether some or all of that can be implemented to address this problem. Vermont's the only state to pass it so far, as you might suspect, and New York, it's pending in legislation there, but it's something that's current. And to read it and to understand the depth and dimension of the proposals, I think, is so important to, once again, make you more aware of things that can be done to bring some sense to this. So maybe we don't have to worry about whether people are going to be cougar hunters for the Wildlife Society anymore, whatever. So I would urge that you really take a look at that and see whether it can get out of Ways and Means Commission. At least have it as a public debate so it's reported in the paper so people understand what this is all about. The ABA, Criminal Justice Section, in 2014 issued a report dealing with collateral consequences. I think it's very worth reading. But one thing struck my curiosity on that. And its conclusion, they made several recommendations. And I thought this makes a lot of sense. It's, we're dealing with public safety issues here this week. Here's what they say. Each collateral consequence should be closely scrutinized and should be required to defend itself. Those that are unduly harsh and unrelated or disproportionate to the crime, once again, there could be some relevant ones, some that make good sense. Certainly, you know, we should have a close look at people who are sexual predators and follow up on that. I have no problem with that. But they should be taken a close look at and see whether or not they're unduly harsh or unrelated or disproportionate to the crime, and they should be eliminated. And only those that further the goals of public safety should be retained. That makes sense. But I think that the state legislative senators and your colleagues should take a look and find out whether these 1,000 collateral consequences in Oregon, whether they each further the goal of public safety. If they do, fine. But if they don't, we don't need any cougar collateral consequences, I don't think, anymore. But you have to look at them all and really discreetly see whether or not it makes sense to do that. Now, I'm going to conclude, I think, pretty quickly. I can talk about a few more things. Perhaps I should pause to tell you what happened with Ms. Nesbitt. I did not put her in jail. I got good grades for doing that, an A grade. I think I'm going to change my name to Frederick A. Block because of it. I feel good about it. And it did trigger a lot of discussion throughout the United States. I feel very good about the fact that that is a collateral consequence of what I did, just to call attention. There was really no need to put her in jail. I put her on probation. I gave her some home confinement. I mean, she's been punished, but I didn't think that she anything positive would be served by putting her in jail. I probably balancing all the factors about whether or not her past was this or that or the nature of the crime, probably would not have put her in jail anyway because of the aberrational nature of her and her whole past and everything else about that. But that to me, whether she was put in jail or not put in jail, was important, of course, to her. But it's almost secondary to the overarching consideration of the fact that this judge, and I think all of my colleagues now are getting on board, are asking themselves, what are the collateral consequences at the time of sentencing? The lawyers have a professional responsibility to tell us about it. I give them homework assignments now. If you haven't put this in your submissions, go back and tell me what they are. The probation department has a responsibility and is doing it now to tell me what the collateral consequences are so I can have proper intelligence and consider the totality of punishment, both the hidden sentences as well as those that are not hidden, in deciding what is the fair and just way to punish a particular defendant. Now, for sure, you need not fear. I'm not going to, you know, tell Al Chapo that he can get out of jail because of collateral consequences. But of course, we have to take a hard look at what we're doing with the drug world and minor felonies and things which really deserve an open look by all of us. So my conclusion from Nesbitt is what I want to read now, if I can take license to read from my own decision, because this is where I want to leave you folks today. And this was written last May. While consideration of the collateral consequences a convicted felon must face should be part of a sentencing judge's calculus, at least in the Second Circuit, at least in the Fourth Circuit, not in the Seventh, 11th, I think, or the Tenth Circuit. Nothing in Oregon has been written about this. Nothing in the Ninth Circuit has been written about this. But I think that there's no question that in my mind that all courts, state and federal level as well, should be part of the calculus, the collateral consequences, the hidden sentences, in arriving at a just punishment. However, I'm just the judge. That's all I can do is write my decisions. I can't tell the legislature what to do. I can't vote. I can do only what I think is necessary in terms of discharging my awesome responsibilities. But this does nothing, of course, my decision in this, to mitigate the fact that those consequences will still attach. It is for Congress, in terms of the 1,300 collateral consequences that have been enacted over the years, and the state's legislatures in respect to the 50,000 collateral consequences that have been enacted throughout the years in all of our states, and 1,000 of them in Oregon, to determine whether the plethora of post-conviction punishments imposed upon felons is truly warranted, and to take a hard look and whether they do the country more harm than good. So in conclusion, I thank you ever so much for letting me come here. That is my clarion call to the state legislators of the state of Oregon. Thank you very much. Any questions? Am I free to go back to Brooklyn now?
Judge Block, before you take off, if we could, one, I want to acknowledge and thank you very much for being here. We did have, if you have a moment for a couple of questions, or do you need to be running out the door?
We're here. I don't have to leave until 7 o'clock tonight.
Wonderful. So we won't stay quite that long because everyone's going to get hungry. First of all, for those who are following or want to look at the collateral consequence bill that was here in Oregon in 2015, it was House Bill 2367A, 2367A. Of course, you can go up on OLIS, you can pull it, and you can see, my understanding, it started in the House Judiciary Committee and then went to Ways and Means, where it stayed and did not come out. So that's something for us and colleagues to be looking at. Our first question that we have is from Representative Sanchez.
Hi, are we on?
Yep.
All right, fabulous. So thank you so much for your presentation. One of the things that we're, of course, here in Oregon, as I'm sure you know, are struggling with is mandatory minimums. So it leaves our judges without enough discretion to do some of the things that you're asking. And we're struggling to try to figure out how do we do that a little bit differently. And I know to a degree, yes, that's our responsibility, but needless to say, not everybody thinks the same way.
Yeah, I don't know of any of my colleagues that really favors mandatory minimums and imposes upon the sound discretion that we're constitutionally obliged to discharge. So we're not in favor of mandatory minimums. We were concerned when Booker was decided by the Supreme Court some years ago, opening up the discretion that federal court judges have, that Congress might retaliate by imposing more mandatory minimums. Happily, that has not happened. We have, most of them deal with serious drug cases and child pornography. We have on the federal level some very harsh mandatory minimum child pornography dynamics. And on the drug level, we have a number of them. Now, a lot of this really, realistically, the legislature has to take a hard look at that because you're taking away discretion from the court. And I think that's a serious matter. I mean, we're supposedly educated and responsible jurists, and I think my colleagues are that way throughout the United States. And I think we ought to have the discretion to do the right thing because sentencing is individualized in each case. So there's this tension between Congress and the judiciary in terms of who should have the power to sentence people. And I think it really is with the judiciary and not with Congress. So we're very leery and concerned about mandatory minimums. Realistically, the judges are on the receiving end because it's the prosecutor's office that exercises the sound discretion in the interests of justice as to how to charge a defendant. So if they want to charge somebody so it triggers a mandatory minimum, we can't do a thing about it. Happily, in the Eastern District of New York, I think we have a wonderful office there. I think they're very responsible. We get few mandatory minimum cases because I think they're sensitive to the fact that they are taking away the discretion from the court. We do have a handful, and usually they create some problems and tensions. I can't say more than that, other than the fact that I obviously don't support mandatory minimums, but it's up to the legislature and the prosecutor's office to decide what comes down to us at the end of the line.
All right, and Judge Block, I just want to take a moment. I had the opportunity to have dinner with you on Wednesday evening with your wife, Betsy.
And I'm going to start biking next week.
Oh, excellent. So let's want to start the biking. And I hope that you had a wonderful visit with Judge McShane down in Eugene.
I did.
And your granddaughter, I believe, you also had an opportunity to see.
I did. I also met with Judge O'Scanlan in Portland. So I come out to haunt you folks periodically because for the last 12 years, you may or may not know that under the law, the circuit court can have on the panel of three one district court judge designated as an acting circuit court judge. And for the last 12 years, you know, they keep asking me to come out here. I don't know. I've been trying to commit reversible error, but they keep inviting me. And it's a pleasure for me to be here. For sure, I'm going to talk to them all about collateral consequences.
Well, I was really concerned as to whether I should be referring to you as judge, but since you're in the Ninth Circuit territory, it should have been Justice Block. we want to thank you very, very much again for coming out and sharing your story and your perspective on how collateral consequences do, in fact, have an impact much longer and broader than many people would can see. I also want to thank all of my colleagues for being here today, as well as all the participants. If you will just stay seated for a moment, we're going to have Abby Stamp. We'll be back up. Abby's going to give us a little bit more direction as to what happens next here at the conference. And so thank you very much for all of our presenters this morning and for all the attendees for being such attentiveness to the presentations.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Brzozinski, and to your colleagues, and to everyone for coming today. This was fabulous to not only organize, but also to participate. I hope this is something we can continue to replicate in years to come. I was just going to tell y'all to go eat, but I have a couple things I want to make sure I say first. There's a few policy and legal themes that emerged. You know, we do what we can to create an agenda that has some thematic and some consistency so that we can all walk away with a singular message. But I want to highlight just a couple. One is that incarceration and prosecution is often not the right response for addiction. We need to invest in forensically responsive treatment and accompanying services, including housing and employment opportunities. We need to decrease collateral consequences to increase an individual's ability to thrive and find recovery. And piggybacking on some of the discussions from this morning and from yesterday, please be diligent. Take informed and calculated risks. Make policy and legal changes that have positive impacts on our communities of color to decrease racial and ethnic disparities in our criminal justice systems. So with that, lunch is going to be a little perhaps chaotic, but that's okay. So we've got representatives from across the state of Oregon, and we've got, well, the actual representatives and senators from across the state. Please go take lunch and find your colleagues from your jurisdictions. We can talk about justice reinvestment funding. We can talk about all of the legal and policy and political issues that individual jurisdictions are grappling with. Again, thank you so very much and enjoy lunch.
And we're adjourned. And all the committees are now adjourned.